Chair Corcoran?
Here.
Representative Ahern?
Here.
Broder is excused. Clark Reed?
Here.
Cummings?
Here.
Edwards? Gibbons? Harrell?
Here.
Hudson is excused. M. Jones?
Here.
S. Jones? Murphy?
Here.
Oliva?
Here.
Petronas?
Here.
Pigman?
Here.
Renuart?
Here.
Robertson?
Here.
Wood?
Here.
Well, Mr. President, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please remember to silence your cell phones. If you testify, please fill in an appearance card and give it to staff. First up, we have Committee Substitute for House Bill 287 by Representative Artiles. Representative Artiles, you're recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, members. Mr. Chairman, I believe we have an amendment.
Do you want to do a brief explanation, and then we'll hit the amendment, if it's all right, Representative
Artiles? Yes, sir. Thank you, Chairman. This amendment does two things. First, it reduces the number of CONs for new community nursing homes beds that ACA may issue from $5,000 to $3,500, or 3,750 beds, which was agreed by all parties, including AARP. And second, it changes the time period from 5 years to 3 years, from 2019 down to 2019 to 2017.
Are there any questions on the amendment? Do we have any public testimony on the amendment? Any debate on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment? So the amendment adopted. You're recognized for the bill.
Thank you, Chairman. HB 287 deals with the Nursing Home Certificate of Needs. In 2001, the legislature placed a moratorium on new nursing home beds in the state of Florida. The moratorium is set to expire March of 2014, when managed care is implemented statewide for long-term care for Medicaid recipients. This bill will update the law to reflect the changes in elderly demographics, as well as the changing long-term care delivery system in the state of Florida. It creates incentives for the nursing home providers to replace older homes with modern buildings to better meet the needs of the current senior population. With the amendment offered today, the bill sets a limit on new nursing home certificate needs for the next 3 years, and this bill has nothing to do with hospital CONs, so I want to make that perfectly clear. This bill has received bipartisan support in both the Senate and the House, as well as unanimous votes, and with that, I request your favorable support of this good bill.
Are there any questions on the bill as amended? Representative Wood, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that we're clear in our understanding of what we're doing here, in regards to the section that we just amended, on July 1st, 2017, would there be no moratorium at that point?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. This actual bill will expire, and then the legislature will have an attempt to either rework it and or put it up again for a vote in both chambers.
That's yes, Representative Wood.
Okay.
Any other questions? Or is there public testimony on the bill? We have Tony Marshall, Senior Director of Reimbursement for the Florida Healthcare Association. Thank you. Jack McRae from AARP. Thank you. And Harold Foster. Thank you. Is there any debate? Representative Wood, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to support the bill today. I think it's an important step in creating new infrastructure in our nursing home industry, and I'm hopeful, and I've been assured that the parameters that we've set today are going to meet the demand that exists in the industry, and I would hope that if it doesn't, that we're able to document what that demand is so that future legislatures can adequately address this issue so that we have the updated infrastructure that this industry needs.
Any other debate? Representative Harrell.
Thank you. I just want to thank you, Representative Artillos, for bringing us a CON bill that doesn't take 3 hours to do.
Any other debate? Representative Artillos, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Chairman. We have close.
Bobby, please call the roll.
Representative Ahern?
Yes.
Representative Brothers, excuse. Clark Reed?
Yes.
Cummings?
Yes.
Edwards?
Yes.
Gibbons?
Yes.
Harrell?
Yes.
Representative Hudson's excused. M. Jones?
Yes.
S. Jones? Murphy?
Yes.
Oliva?
Yes.
Petronas?
Yes.
Pigman?
Yes.
Renuart?
Yes.
Robertson?
Yes.
Wood?
Yes.
Chair Corcoran?
Yes.
Bill passes.
Show the bill reported favorably as amended. Thank you, Representative Tillies. Next up, we have House Bill 7021, Sexually Violent Predators, by Representative Harrell. Representative Harrell, you're recognized. You can go to the podium or from your desk, whatever you prefer. There's a strike all amendment on the desk, so why don't you get right to the strike call and just let us know how it differs from the original bill as you explain the strike call, Representative Harrell, if that's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members. This is a very, very important bill. As you may have heard, there's been many incidents. There was a tragic incident in Jacksonville area where a young lady, a young child, was killed by a violent sexual predator who had been released, actually was in a local jail and was released and was never referred for evaluation of the civil commitment process. And as you know, members, in the state of Florida, we have a process when someone is convicted of a violent sexual predator that they are referred for civil commitment. And this is an extensive process that must meet very specific constitutional requirements in order to do this. And this bill is part of a package of bills that the Speaker and the President of the Senate have really designated as a response to making our communities more safe from violent sexual predators. And it's part of their work plan for 2014. And this is the section that deals with the civil commitment process. It is the Criminal Justice Committee. It has a package of bills that they are looking at that deals with the criminal justice side of this entire issue on how we deal with violent sexual predators. And we have worked very diligently on this with our Senate partners. And the strike all amendment that's before you today is really the negotiated package between the House and the Senate. How this eventually reaches the floor, we're still working on, but this is the House version of where we are going to address violent sexual predators through the civil commitment process. And what it does is it strengthens the law to ensure that offenders are professionally and thoroughly evaluated for civil commitment as sexual violent predators in a way that still meets the constitutional requirements. And don't forget, we have to be very specific in how we do this. We have to, these individuals not only have to be shown to be dangerous, but to meet the constitutional muster, they also have to have a mental abnormality, so that there is an absolutely necessary process that has to be done. This enhances the training, the contracting training, feedback, and evaluation requirements for clinicians who make up the multidisciplinary team that does the evaluation of these individuals, and to help them make better decisions as to who they recommend to the state attorney's office in order to file for this, the civil action that has to take place. It provides for involvement of the state attorneys, the sheriffs, and victims' advocates in reviewing the offenders for filing for commitment in a way that maintains the constitutionality of the program. And it also lowers the number of disciplinary team member votes needed to recommend for filing to the state attorney. The differences between the strike all, what the strike all and the original bill really are very, very close, but what we've done in our way in compromising and in working with our Senate partners is that this provides more detail about the training and evaluation of the members of the multidisciplinary team. It allows the state attorneys to review both the potential positive and negative recommendations and request in writing for the multidisciplinary team to reconsider if they disagree. It also requires DCF to prioritize referrals by release date, but to provide them to the state attorneys at least 90 days before the offender's release date in most cases. And it requires DCF to track key statistics about the operations and outcomes of their processes so they have greater awareness of the issues and can take action to correct them. And it directs the multidisciplinary team to weigh the offender's attempts to commit sexually violent offenses as heavily as if they had been committed. And that is the amendment. It's a strike-all amendment, so I've included everything in that.
Thank you, Representative Farrell. Other questions? Dr. Renouart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the multidisciplinary team. What is the typical makeup and how many members are on this team?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Yeah, I've got my husband's cold. The multidisciplinary team is made up of psychologists, PhD psychologists, and psychiatrists. This has got to be a clinical process. It usually consists of 5 to 7 members. The individual who has done the evaluation is either a PhD-level psychologist or psychiatrist, and his report is given to that team. There is a evaluation done. If there's disagreement about that, you can require a second evaluation, but it is a clinical process. If you have 2 positive votes, it is then referred to the state attorney's office. Now, the state attorney does not have to move forward if they choose not to. If they feel that the case is not valid and they're not going to win, they do not have to move forward. But it then, that's a state attorney's decision. It then goes to a trial, and that can either be a jury trial or a bench trial.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, I know it said it was at least 2 psychiatrists or 2 psychologists or mixed of those, and there may be as many as 5 or 7 members on the board. Would there ever be a situation where 2 members of the board that are not behavioral health professionals would make that determination?
You recognize?
No. There must be, because this is a clinical process to meet constitutional muster, that multidisciplinary team is made up only of clinical psychologists and psychiatrists.
Representative Gibbons for a question.
Yes, thank you, Mrs. Chair. But regardless of the recommendation, the decision still remains with the city attorney. Is that correct?
You're recognized.
Thank you. That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate very much the work that you've done on a very bipartisan level to have no one vote against this bill as it works through the process is a tremendous feat, so I thank you for that. I'm very interested to know, however, about the qualifications for these clinicians who are making the recommendations. What was concerning was when the papers came out and reported, and then subsequently we had our chief, who was in charge of this program, resign. I'm concerned about the rulemaking process and how much leverage we're going to give DCF and this agency to determine who can make these recommendations and then how they determine what is a sexually violent predator who then would be required or then recommended for this type of civil commitment. So what are we doing to make sure that we're not too narrow on those who we believe should be confined and those who we want to protect their civil liberties?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you make very valid points, and this is really the crux of this bill. What we did, and I have to give you a little history, members. There was a time, and if you look in your analysis, you can see the chart which shows the referral process. And over the years, let me get my analysis out here. Over the years, if you look at this chart, There's been a fluctuation in the numbers of referrals, and certainly a lot of this depends on how many people are being released from their various sentences. So that's part of the natural thing, the natural referral pattern, but there's been a decrease in those referred. This process we're putting in place now will probably increase, when you look at the criminal justice bills that are coming, will probably increase the number of referrals. Over the years, since the beginning of this program, which was started under the Jimmy Rice Act in, I believe, 1998, you have seen the numbers fluctuate. And there's been about 48,000 people referred. Of those, there's been about 1,600 who were actually referred to the state attorney to go through the civil commitment process. Currently, there are about 641 people at the Civil Commitment Center in Arcadia. There was a drop-off in referrals at one point, and we have put into statute a lot of the newer requirements that the agency has, that the department has done on a voluntary basis with a new director. There's a question about the previous director feeling that we were not getting enough commitments, kind of lowered the bar a little bit. We may have fewer ultimate commitments, but we're going to be screening more people with the requirements that we are putting in. We're going to be meeting constitutional muster under this, and we're institutionalizing so that there can't be that fluctuation. A lot of this evaluation process, that's the focus of this bill, making sure those multidisciplinary teams have the appropriate people, that they are clinically appropriate to do this, and that there's an evaluation process yearly, especially on those evaluators, those independent contractors who are actually going out and doing that face-to-face interview with the individual. So I think we are meeting that requirement. We may wind up with fewer people actually going, eventually getting through the court system, because in a way, we're going to be screening more people, and we're also, with only two votes, it will be easier to refer them to the state attorney. Now, the state attorney is going to make a decision. Is this a valid, is this something I can win in court? Because there's a judicial process. So the state, a lot of burden, not burden, a lot of decision making will be on the state attorney. He's going to get probably more referrals to him, and he will make that decision.
Any other questions? Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Harrell, this question is coming from someone that doesn't really have a whole lot of knowledge of this process. But just for clarification, this evaluation process that is necessary before the state attorney can file a petition, that evaluation process is then not part of the trial. Is that correct? It's not able to be put into evidence.
You recognize?
I believe that report from the evaluator may be part of the process in the court. I am not an attorney, so I don't quite know whether that is or not. This evaluation process is extremely important to get the individual before the court. The state attorney takes all that information in the evaluation process and makes a determination whether or not they have a strong enough case and that there's a clinical reason to do this. And you have to prove to the court that this person has a mental abnormality and that this evaluation process is the key to that. So I would anticipate that that psychologist or psychiatrist, it comes before the court and testifies. I can't imagine that that might not happen, but I'm not an attorney, so I can't tell you that.
Chair, does staff have the answer to the question?
Ms. DCF? You recognize, yeah.
We have the director of the program with us, and I will defer to her.
You remember to fill out an appearance card, too, please.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Kristen Kanner on behalf of the department. Yes, the reports, as a prerequisite to file a petition, as you know, maybe you don't know, I prosecuted these cases. I've been a prosecutor, was a prosecutor for 21 years, and I prosecuted these cases for the last 9 years of my career. In order to file a petition, you have to file the actual reports from the evaluators along with the letter. Currently, the status of the law is along with the letter recommending that the state attorney's office file a petition. Those are prerequisites for the state attorney to be able to file a petition. And in fact, the state attorney's office does present psychological evidence. That's really all the evidence that you do present is psychological evidence at the trial, because the issue at trial is whether it's the person's current mental state. It's not their mental state 20 years ago when they were sentenced or 10 years ago in prison. It's their mental state today and whether or not they're likely to reoffend in the future if not confined for long-term care, control, and treatment. I'd say 95% of these cases are jury trials, and the standard is clear and convincing evidence, so it's not the preponderance standard for a traditional civil case, and it's not beyond a reasonable doubt for a traditional criminal case. It's right there in the middle. It's a little bit elevated. And some of them can be trickier cases, especially because we're not just dealing with child victims and pedophiles. We're dealing also with adult victims. There's I'd say about 25 to 40% of the people at the center right now are adult rapists. And their diagnosis is traditionally, and this doesn't include everybody, but it's called a paraphilia NOS, or not otherwise specified. It's a paraphilia is another word for sexual deviance. And what we're really looking for when we're evaluating people is that the behavior or their behavior is being driven by their diagnosis. So we're looking for people who are offending because they are so compelled to offend that they have a mental abnormality and or personality disorder. We also have personality disorders. So people that are extremely antisocial and commit many offenses, some of which are sex offenses, are also qualified, even if they don't have a sexual deviance. So back to the original question. Yes, you have to have it is psychological testimony that comes in. The reports are part of the actual prosecutor's file and are distributed in discovery. Depositions are taken. It's a whole judicial process.
Follow up, Representative Wood.
And thank you for your testimony, but the specific, and it's really more of a procedural issue. I mean, what you're saying is whatever's in the report, that report is not going to become part of the record in the trial. What's in that report has to be reintroduced in evidence through testimony or whatever to give due process.
Yes, sir. Okay. And with that, I think some circuits, so it's a prosecutorial discretion to whether to physically admit the report or not into evidence. I did not. I got it in through the testimony of the doctor, but some circuits do admit the report physically.
You recognize?
Well, I would have a problem if the report is allowed to be put into evidence because there's no due process in the clinical evaluation. I mean, the respondent, I mean, the predator does not have the ability to be represented or have other testimony or other things like that. I certainly understand what you're saying. Once that predicate is laid, you can go forward with a trial. But why would we allow a report to be introduced and shown to the trier of fact when the conclusions and how that report was done have been done outside of the presentation of the trial?
I don't know. Honestly, they are given the right to refuse the face-to-face evaluation when the evaluators come to the prison. They're not required to meet with people. About 60% of them do meet with the evaluators when they come. About 40% of them do not. So they have the right to refuse that, and they're told that at the outset of that, and there's a form that they sign, whether they refuse or they agree to have the discussion. The evaluators, you know, obviously testify about everything that is in the report,
right.
And the report is admitted into evidence at the outset because there's an ex parte probable cause hearing that the court reviews those, and those are in the court file. Currently, obviously, because of electronic filing, those are sealed, and those are a notice of HIPAA issues, and that protected information is in that file online.
Chair, I'll let other people talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you very much. Maybe this is a more appropriate question for the individual who just spoke, but in speaking with psychologists and other trained clinicians who helped administer these programs, I think at the core of this and what we're really trying to do besides protect individuals' liberties is make sure that these individuals who have abnormalities don't continue to reoffend. When you speak with some of these professionals And you ask them, they'll say, you know, folks come in and they recognize, yes, there is something in my brain that gives me this impulse. I would like to know if they have the availability to ask for voluntary chemical castration combined with therapy within our system to help them stop that impulse from becoming a sexually violent reoffender.
You're recognized.
I think on that question, I will have to defer to the director of the program. Kristen?
You're recognized.
Thank you. In the prison system, within the criminal justice system, there is a provision where they can be ordered to have chemical castration. It's not enforced very often, and I've only seen really one case where it was enforced, and actually that was a physical castration, and it was voluntary, and it was for that reason. He recognized, but it was done at the center based on the criminal order that he be castrated, either chemically or physically, and that was, again, voluntary. But there is a provision in the criminal justice system where they can be ordered to chemical castration.
Representative Oliva.
Thank you, Chairman. Just as a follow-up on that, what have been the results in those very rare cases where there has been a chemical castration? Have we seen a drastic reduction? Does that seem to solve whatever abnormality they have? Where does the abnormality lie?
You're recognized.
The abnormality lies in their And again, this is a developing science, if you will, and the abnormality lies within not necessarily their chemical brain structure, but in their personality development. So the treatment is very behavioral-based, but I don't know that there's recidivism data with people that have had that. This particular individual that I was involved with is still at the center, so he hasn't been released to test whether or not he would reoffend. And he's elderly, and it's, you know, he was over 70. When he had this done. So I don't know that there are viable recidivism statistics on that.
Any other questions? We don't have any public testimony on the strike call. Is there any debate on the strike call? Seeing none, we're now on the bill as amended with the strike call. Is there any questions on the bill as amended? Public testimony, we have Ron Buck, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you know, once a year for the last 4 years, now going into the fifth year, my daughter laces up her sneakers and walks from Key West to Tallahassee to raise awareness and education on this issue. And that's because we learned about 6 or 7 years ago from the Justice Department and the Center for Missing and Exploited Children that 95% of childhood sexual abuse is preventable with education and awareness. And for several years, my daughter wanted to go to Arcadia as she walked past the Jimmy Rice Civil Commitment Facility, and we kept her from going there. Last year, during her walk, she stopped. And she spent the better part of a Saturday not only talking to the people that work there from a professional perspective, but she talked to the guards that were there, and she had an opportunity to have an exchange with an individual who had been civilly committed to the facility. When she finished her walk, she got here to Tallahassee, and on the night that she got that she finished the walk, she had an opportunity to spend several hours upstairs in this building with Chairman Gates and Representative Harrell and the staff director of the Criminal Justice Subcommittee, talking about what she learned on the walk and specifically what she learned at Civil Commitment Facility. So you sort of fast forward some of those ideas and discussions into the events of the last year. Go no further than Representative Hudson in the last row and the experience that they had in Jacksonville with the Cherish Periwinkle case. And then you fast forward into the series that each of you have had an opportunity to read because we sent the series to you from the Sun Sentinel, which was titled Sexual Predators Unleashed. And what we learned from all of that was that we had a director who at that time, during his tenure in Arizona and tenure here, decided to superimpose his thought process on what the screen should look like for those who were otherwise incarcerated under the criminal statutes of Florida and who would be looked at from a civil review perspective, sexually violent, mental abnormality, and whether or not, in his opinion, maybe there were some civil rights issues that the courts have otherwise said, including, Mr. Chairman, as you know, the United States Supreme Court has said that states have the right to civilly commit an individual for the rest of their lives after their completion of their criminal sentence. This process begins prior to the end of their criminal sentence. And in the case of Cherish Periwinkle, here's what we know. What we know is 10 years ago, the individual who committed that crime had been briefly reviewed. Somehow he fell outside of their screen and didn't get moved forward in the civil commitment process. The legislation in front of you today sets parameters, tighter parameters. While Ms. Kanner is a former prosecutor and prosecuted these cases and understands them and understands not only the science of the abnormalities and the violence of these individuals, but she understands the victim's perspective as well. She won't always be there. Secretary Yacobo won't always be there. And there'll be administrations that come and go long after you all leave. This legislation attempts to tighten up what those screens look like, and try to limit, if you will, staff superimposing their public policy beliefs as opposed to what you as lawmakers determine the public policy to be. In the Periwinkle case, this bill will shut down the loophole that otherwise had that man in jail, 364 days in a county jail. He couldn't get reviewed again. This bill makes sure that those that end up in our jail system, because they've somehow pled down to a lesser offense and end up in the jail system, it allows the jail system to refer people into this civil commitment process. Mr. Chairman, through you to Representative Wood, here's what I would say about the issue of a report being entered into at the civil commitment trial. There's plenty of due process for that public defender at taxpayers' expense to challenge what that multidisciplinary team put before the state attorney in an evidentiary perspective to determine whether or not the experts were right or wrong. We allow probable cause affidavits to be entered into in the process. It allows cross-examination coming and going. It allows reviews. I'm not sure why there would be a concern in putting the findings of a multidisciplinary team that simply are referred to a state attorney for review to determine whether or not they want to file that civil action for a review of whether that person should be civilly committed. And let me just say to you on the issue of mental abnormality, let me tell you what 12 and a half years of research, of reading, every periodical, every study, even those that are written by people I don't agree with, all of them will tell you the same thing. All of them, 100%. All of them will reoffend. All counseling and the rehab does to these men and women, all it does is teach them about what triggers their sexually deviant behaving habits. That's all it does. It teaches them that they should avoid a particular smell, avoid a particular sound, avoid images on a computer or on a television, avoid periodicals that would otherwise stimulate that sexually deviant behavior. It teaches them how to control those triggers, but it does not cure them. They continue to have the abnormality, period, paragraph. I don't care what expert you talk to. You can talk to the experts who counsel these individuals in the MDSO programs. And I don't generally agree with many of the things that they say, but they all say the same thing. They all will reoffend. The average predator will commit 124 separate offenses before they get caught. We have to put them away for longer periods of time, and you're doing that with the minimum mandatory sentencing bill that you will hear when you get here 2 weeks from now. But this bill shuts down loopholes that we have all found that the Sun Sentinel went to great lengths to point out in their series. Chemical castration, Mr. Chairman, through you to Representative Edwards, through you to Representative Oliva, let me be clear. You heard from Kristen Cantor. The evidence is not clear. What we know is if you simply look at one aspect of sexual offending, chemical castration will not deal with aspects of what these deviant behaving individuals do to their victims, period. It is not all about whether or not they have intercourse type relationships. It is about what they do with other parts of their body. And quite candidly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the statute of limitations bill that you will also hear, at the end of the day, that bill is about primarily finding a loophole. We found individuals that we thought were otherwise covered when the statute of limitations in the Dorworth bill was repealed originally. We thought we caught, and we found out there was a series of crimes where there was no penetration by the offender, but it did not change the lewd and lascivious, bad-acting impacts on the victim of those crimes. And so if we're looking for chemical castration to simply minimize one level of urges, I would suggest to you that while it's got its proper place in Florida law, nobody should look at chemical castration as some end-all to sexually deviant behaving individuals. Mr. Chairman, I've had the opportunity, as is my daughter, to testify in a number of committees that have heard all of the bills that are going to be part of the package that this legislature takes up its first 2 weeks of session. Face on a crime, face on a subject matter. For 12 years, I've been coming to these committees and to this body and to the body on the other side of the hallway, encouraging the passage of laws that better protect children and families. A week ago Monday, my daughter and I had a chance to speak to the 3,000 women volunteers in New York City that are part of their Junior League organization. And we talked to them about how people in Washington, D.C. run for public office and people in legislatures around the country outside of Florida run. And the first thing they say is, we're for protecting children. And the second thing they say is, we're for protecting families. I can't speak for the people in Washington, D.C. that don't seem to believe that after they get there. And I can't speak for legislatures like the New York legislature. We went there because they were seeking advice on how to better protect children and families. I can speak about Florida legislature. And in 12 years, every meaningful bill that has come before this body to better protect children and families has been adopted and passed. And that includes the bills that you will take up, including this one, those first 2 weeks of the legislative session. I have never, as a parent, as a taxpayer, as an individual affected by a sexually deviant behaving individual, been prouder to be a part of a system that protects children and families than what this legislature does. And in the tenure that all of you are here and those of you who will leave at the end of this year, my friend, Representative Gibbons, who wears an awareness bracelet every single day and has for years, nothing you will ever do will have a longer legacy and a longer impact on children and families in hopefully deterring and putting away the bad guys and the bad gals longer than the package of bills that you will take up this legislative session, including this one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Is there any debate? Representative Wood, you're recognizing debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to recognize my good friend, Mr. Book, and his passion for this issue, and I think we all share his words of wisdom. And my question that I posed, and I predicate with that I'm uninformed in this area, and after having a chance to review the 394 statute and looking at the provisions of that, I am satisfied that due process is protected. And my question was The concern of my question is, and as the sponsor of the bill indicated, we have to be very, very careful in drafting this legislation so that we do not violate constitutional rights, because the worst thing that can happen is we put something in the law that is the basis for overturning something. And so that was the motivation of my question. I am a strong supporter of this initiative. I applaud the sponsor of the bill. I applaud the legislature. And as Mr. Book eloquently stated, this is something that the people of Florida deserve for us to move forward on. So I will be supporting the bill, and thank you for the time given me.
Representative Givens.
Gotcha. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Harrell, thank you for bringing this forward. As Mr. Book says, I proudly wear this bracelet, and I'm also fortunate to have served on the Board of Henderson Mental Health Centers with Kristen Canner for 8 to 10 years. So we've been involved in this issue, and I applaud you for bringing this forward. This really helps us go in the right direction. So thank you very much.
Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to thank, of course, Gail Harrell for working this issue. It's not an easy issue, but I think you're doing the right thing. And certainly for Mr. Book for his testimony, I appreciate the insight. He actually mentioned a lot of things that I was going to put in my debate right here. But unfortunately, medical science has not really found the fix for the disconnect in the brains of these people. We have fallen short. The castration, unfortunately, it does not cure this problem. It may decrease some aggressiveness, but this is a problem in the brain, and it has to do with certain connections, and it's a focus that's in the brain that we have not found a way to treat. Unfortunately, civil commitment at this time is the only thing that we can do to truly protect our Florida public. And these are the issues that we need to look for, and I'm supporting this bill today.
Any other debate? Representative Hill, you're advised to close on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. And I especially want to thank Mr. Book for his testimony. I could basically let him close. But I do want to thank our staff, because Hillary and Chris have been remarkable, and Kristen Kenner, I've met with her several times, and we've worked on this together. I also had the opportunity, as Mr. Book's daughter had, to go to the Civil Commitment Center. And I wanted to see firsthand that we were indeed treating these individuals. They have committed horrendous crimes, but we have a constitutional responsibility to make sure that they are receiving, that they are being confined, but that this is because of their emotion, their mental status, their mental abnormality or personality disorder, and that we, in order to meet constitutional muster, must be providing them with the appropriate treatment. I agree with Representative Renewart. I don't know that we are ever there in being able to cure these people, but we have to, as part of our determination to make sure we are doing this in an appropriate way, we have got to meet the constitutional requirements and provide them with the best level of treatment that we know at this time that we know is possible. And I believe we are doing that. I think this bill in particular codifies in place, in statute, the ability to have an appropriate process in place, that you're not going to have the deviation depending on who is secretary, who is director, who is happens to be in charge at the time. We're putting safeguards here without getting so restrictive that we really tie the hands of the department to be able to administer a program. We are making public policy here that is going to safeguard our families, our children, and the population of Florida. So I think this is a key component to the entire package, and you'll be seeing, if you sit on Judiciary, you'll be seeing that in Judiciary probably the first week of session, and we will all be seeing it on the floor probably the second week of session. So I encourage you to support this bill and actively go out and let people know that the state of Florida is standing up against sexually violent predators. Thank you.
Thank you. Bobby, please call the roll on House Bill 721 as amended by the strike call.
Representatives Ahern?
Yes.
Brothers excused. Clark Reed?
Yes.
Cummings?
Yes.
Edwards?
Yes.
Gibbons?
Yes.
Harrell?
Yes.
Representative Hudson is excused. M. Jones?
Yes.
S. Jones?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Oliva?
Yes.
Petronas?
Yes.
Pigman?
Yes.
Renuart?
Yes.
Roberson?
Yes.
Wood?
Yes.
Chair Corcoran?
Yes.
The bill passes.
So the bill reported favorably as amended. Thank you, Representative Harrell. Next up, we have consideration of House Bill 97 by Representative Magar and Representative Spano. You're recognized, Representative Spano.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present House Bill 97. House Bill 97 relates to dentists and dental hygienists. A few years ago, the legislature passed the Access to Healthcare Act, which was enacted to provide sovereign immunity to healthcare professionals who provided indigent and low-income care, and that included dental care professionals. Unfortunately, it was probably what could be characterized as a glitch, and it didn't allow dentists to pass along the laboratory costs. For instance, the cost for example, bridges, crowns, dentures, and those types of things. And so, if a dentist wanted to provide this care and wanted to still maintain that immunity, he or she would have to actually come out of pocket to pay those costs for those fixtures. I don't think that was the legislature's intent. I don't think it is the legislature's intent. So essentially what this bill would do would be to allow an indigent or low-income family or a third party, if need be, or is the case, to actually pay for those costs and allow the dentist or the hygienist to provide that care and still maintain that sovereign immunity. Pretty simple. That's what the bill is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Spano? Seeing none, is there any public testimony? We have Ron Watson from the Dental Association. Thank you. Any other public testimony? Is there any debate? Representative Petronis, you're recognizing the debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Spano, thank you for doing it. I've specifically just bring this up because I know Representative Magar is home watching on TV. You do this, and I just want to thank you publicly on behalf of Elise, the Florida House, for stepping up while she's recuperating and carrying her legislation for us so she can handle it when it hits the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Petronis. Well said. Any other questions? Debate? Seeing none, you're recognized to close on the bill.
Wave close, Mr. Chairman.
Bobby, please call the roll on House Bill 97.
Representatives Ahern? Representative Brothers, excuse. Clark Reed? Cummings?
Yes.
Edwards?
Yes.
Gibbons?
Yes.
Harrell?
Yes.
Representative Hudson's excused. M. Jones?
Yes.
S. Jones?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Oliva?
Yes.
Petronas?
Yes.
Pigman?
Yes.
Renuart?
Yes.
Roberson?
Yes.
Wood?
Yes.
Chair Corcoran?
Yes.
The bill passes.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Wood moves we rise without objection, so the committee terminated. Thank you.